Oh, my goodness, the rural crops is before us.
Real quickly, just bum, 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 bum. House Committee on Revenue for Tuesday, May 5th, 2009, will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3305. Mazin?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Happy Cinco de Mayo. We'll start the tequila afterwards.
Not until after 10 o'clock, please.
Okay. House Bill 3305 is dealing primarily with the issues that we have on the estate tax. This whole process started way back in 2007, a regular session, where we started with a simple idea of raising the threshold for what we have come to define as a natural resource properties. This is properties including farmland, woodlands, small woodlands, fisheries, and nurseries, and the like, to a seven and a half million threshold. Once, of course, we've done that. We started a life employment for economists and lawyers.
and we
started changing this ever since. As you remember, in the 2008 February small session, we went through a whole revamp of these sections of the law. In that, what we've done is we introduced... A credit table instead of the just one-time seven and a half million kind of cliff. And the credit table takes out credit for full payments or full amounts due up to $7.5 million, and then goes gradually down all the way to the $15 million. However, the amounts that are qualified under the new law came with a little bit of description of the 50% being natural resource property, having the material participation clauses and the definition of who is inheriting the natural resource business of being relative or close relative and so on. The bill in front of you will give you a number of things. Changes are in this policy. You'd have a change. This is introduces first of all the CPI indexing, which means the table will start increasing with time. The second thing, it takes out the credit table up to $7.5 million. That, I guess, will clarify with time. Then expands significantly the working capital definition and gives a new limit on the working capital definition to 20% of the total assets, not only the $15 million of natural resource properties, but 20% of the total assets of the estate. And then you have the new definition for cash conversion cycle. This is the amount that should be needed for the cash conversion for the working capital and so on. The amendments on page 4 seem also to expand eligibility by specifying whether the federal elections being not binding on the Oregon returns and so on. That's quickly what you have in front of you. We could always have a lot more discussion as you go through the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, we are joined by three and I think perhaps five illustrious members of the House, and we should hear from them first. Gentlemen and lady, please.
Okay, Representative Barnhart, I'll start if it's okay. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative for District 1. And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go back, and some of these committee members weren't here in 2007, to give you a forestry perspective, because I've actually got what I wrote in 2007, and there's something very telling in there. And my colleagues here will go into some of the issues that the present bill addresses. And I referred to the legislation in 2007, which was House Bill 3479, as the Family Forest and Farm Preservation Act, trying to preserve those lands. There's been a steady loss of private family forests and agricultural lands. In the case of forest lands, they have to be sold or clear cut to pay the owed death tax. A death tax obligation for a forest landowner of $100,000 doesn't mean it's going to cost you $100,000. You will have to cut enough trees to pay for the death tax, the state income tax, the personal property tax on the logging equipment, a federal income tax, a severance tax, a forestry tax, a property tax on the actual property. Then you'd have to do your reforestation costs, management and maintenance costs. And if you do the work yourself, as many of us do, you can work ourselves to death until the next generation can start the tax process again. To get to $100,000, you may have to cut $300,000 worth of trees. You may have to cut them at a time the market is down, thereby losing value and causing more trees to be cut. And that is the emphasis. Back in 2007, I cautioned what would happen if the market went down. Today in Curry County, we don't have a mill operating. When I got there years ago, there were 11. We'd have to ship 110 miles one way. With the price of timber today, you would go in the hole paying all those obligations, and you could not sell that timber. So what would happen if someone died in 2008, 2007, coming in 2008, and you're trying to get your obligation paid within that time that the IRS gives you the opportunity? You would have to sell the property if you didn't have enough revenue in the bank, or you'd have to take on a new loan. Imagine trying to get a loan today on any type of agriculture or farmland with the markets where they are. And the original bill would make it possible for family-owned natural resource lands to be passed from generation to generation, promote stewardship and conservation of those lands. It would provide an opportunity for young people to stay, live, raise their families in farms and forest land. And it's basically the same for the commercial fish industry, where they have a lot of investment in their boats, equipment. And large corporations who have similar assets don't pay inheritance tax. They don't pay that same tax on the same real estate. Why make farmers, ranchers, forest landowners, commercial fishermen pay a death tax? They have already paid a tax. In closing, I want to say that I did not appreciate the Oregon Department of Revenue's obvious attempt to circumvent the legislative intent of the original bill. Now, we maybe didn't get the wording right, but I think they went way beyond that. And that's why I will be voting no on their budget as long as I am in this building. Thank you.
Well, that's a hard act to follow. But good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I am Deborah Boone, and I represent House District 32. And I won't go over, you've got my written testimony, I won't go over everything in there. It's a little bit of a wrap-up of the last three sessions. And I think with this Dash 1 amendment that you have today, we're almost there. We'll almost get there. There's probably a few little tweaks that need to be done. But I think that Representative Krieger stated it very well. The purpose of this legislation is to preserve these lands and fishing boats. We added commercial fishing boats because really that is a natural resource, and the only way people could have paid that tax, they couldn't cut trees or sell more fish because they have to fish to get them. If they die, they're gone. But they would have to de-gear their boats, and that just doesn't make sense. They would end up with a boat that couldn't fish. So all these natural resource-based businesses support their families. Most of these people have a trust agreement for their financial planning. They've made these plans, and they've taken care of it, but some don't. And they're land rich and cash poor. Maybe they can't afford an attorney or a financial planner. But this is to keep these lands from being deforested just for the purpose of paying the property or the inheritance tax, so that they can go on being a family forest or whatever, or a farmland, vineyards, etc., and used for that purpose. And we're all worried about climate change now, and so there's nothing better than a small forest in your neighborhood or several to help with that problem. So you're going to hear from a lot of other members of this work group that has been convened in the interims. And that's plural because it's happened a couple of times. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I hope you support this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Boone mentioned dash one. Is there a dash one or are we talking about the bill?
I'm sorry, I was talking about the bill.
Thank you. I'm seriously looking for a dash one.
I hadn't seen the dash one either. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Berger.
There is going to be a dash one.
My name is Arne Roblin, for the record, House District 9 representative. I'm here. This bill origin started in 2007 in the Ag and Natural Resource Committee, of which I was chair, and it is one that is dear to me for a lot of different reasons. And I guess what I would start out by saying is that if you look at Oregon structure and land use, you recognize that the people of Oregon made a decision when we implemented our land use laws, and in that we said we want to keep farming, farmland, and forest lands in our state, and we want to preserve them. And so the tax structure was changed to actually give them a very big advantage with respect to how they pay their taxes on those lands. And to, I think, our credit, we recognize that there is an expense, and that the rest of Oregon needs to help with that. I wish that as we go on and look at other things, we would recognize that because we're giving those exemptions, counties really get hurt as opposed to the state, and we have to figure that out at some point. But the reality is, we as a state made a decision that we were willing, actually, to give up tax money so that we would continue to have farming. Well, this is just a continuation of that same recognition that for these small landowners and small business people, we as Oregonians believe we want to keep in place these working family farms. As people know, with the sesquicentennial, we have a number of sesquicentennial farms. We have over 100, I can't remember exactly how many, centennial farms, and those keep growing. That means that those same families have continuously farmed forest land, and this one is just the farms, for over 100 and over 150 years. Some of them go back into the territorial times with the same family ownership. That's something that we prize in Oregon, and it's fairly unique to Oregon when you consider the numbers that we have and that are doing that. This bill says, and that concept was, we need to make sure that that continues to happen. And so the one little part I would talk to has to do with the working capital, and I like the new definition of working capital, because it isn't just, you know, the property itself. People who have been working these things for 100 years did the important things, which was, even in the good years, they set aside money and they lived lean because they knew the bad years were going to come. Weather makes a big difference. The market makes a big difference. They have to be prepared for that. Equipment breaks down. They've got to take care of that. And it isn't over a one-year cycle. It's over a 10- and 15-year cycle. If you're going to replace the tractor, if you're going to replace a combine, except you're not going to do that in an individual small farm, but you may be going in with a group of people. But if you're going to keep the equipment there and stuff going, you have to have your 20-year resources that you're figuring out, how do I make sure that when the time comes that I need the new tractor or the repair, or in the fishing industry, that we do the repairs to the fishing boat, and then the annual requirement that it has to be safe and you have to have all this equipment has to be there, so that if, in fact, we really do prize keeping these family businesses, we've got to make allowances so that the person that takes over still has that working ability to keep that farm going. If I take out all of the working capital, or just say I can only keep a year, if I do that, then the new person coming in is put at immediate risk with respect to whether they can keep it going. And I appreciate the work that the work group did in coming up and trying to explain how each of these different businesses really managed to stay afloat, and what the kinds of things that they have to put aside in the good times to make sure they can make it through the bad times, and to anticipate the needs down the road for those farms. And I will say that those family farms that have done that for the past 150 years have made those commitments generation after generation to make sure that they stay there. I hope that at 200 years and the bicentennial of the state and so on, we will continue to see these family farms owned by the same families continuing to provide the sustenance that we need as citizens in this state for Oregon. And I think this bill is one of those that does that. I appreciate the indexing of the $7.5 million because I think as time goes on, if you don't do some of those kinds of things, you get back to the same place we were at the beginning of this process when you don't have... you haven't protected enough to keep the working family farm, the fishing industry, the nursery, the small nursery business afloat. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I hope that you consider strongly these amendments, and I appreciate the hard work that you as a committee are doing. So thank you, and we look forward to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Arnie, Representative Roblin, are you the one who ought to walk through the definitions of working capital, material property recovery account, and then the section on page 2 in which the limitations
I've looked,
are set, or should we ask someone else that question?
I think on the working capital group, I understood the issue, but not to the depth that this goes through it, so I think that the other people would be better.
There are other people in the room who heard the question.
And they will be ready.
The ones who know the answer should give it in their testimony.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I just make a comment?
Yes,
please. Representative Roblin, my esteemed Rules Committee Chair, I understand that this original bill is dear to you, but this is my third round on this bill. It's not dear to me anymore. But I do appreciate what we're trying to get at, and I think that we've done good work here. But don't ever call this the dear bill.
No, we'll keep it away from the dear bill.
And is that D-E-E-R or D-E-A-R?
Yes, and many of the family farms produce and help keep those deer alive by offering to let their hard-earned crops go to the feeding of our wildlife, including those deer, so that other sportsmen and others can take advantage of the opportunity presented.
They're deer.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I can see I've opened another subject, and I apologize to the committee for that.
Oh, dear. Mr. Chair, he's talking about deer, and my favorite animal is the bear. I've had people from the governor's office down, Roy Elker, the director. I have a $400,000 loss on my tree farm. Black bears, so we do feed them.
Thank you very
much.
Well,
Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Berger would rather refer to this as the bear bill than
the deer bear bill. Thank you very much.
Now, I understood that there were other representatives who wanted to be heard.
I have to go release one. My chair will be down in a few moments, but you can take some other testimony first.
All right. Thank you. Jeff Stone, and I'm going to mess up some names here. Tammy Denny, and should I hear Jeff Sheen now?
Or we could save a spot, Mr. Chair, for
that'd be fine. Let's do that. Representative Schaffler, I suspect, huh? Go ahead.
He comes in like a squall. You know, it's.
You'll notice
we feel his presence whenever he's near. Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm pleased to actually be before you again, Representative Berger, to talk about the estate tax bill. You have prepared testimony from me, which I'll only highlight for you this morning, and it goes into great detail about the why and how we got here. But let's not make a mistake of diminishing the landmark nature of this bill. $7.5 million tax credit will help a vast majority of my members who are smaller. Those who have significant holdings, like our larger nurseries, would not make use of this tax credit, nor as we developed last year, should they? If you have a $15 million asset base, that's what this bill was intended to try to help, you know, those individuals. I would state that there are some very good components, and we have two practitioners here to answer all your questions. I am not that person. Sean Cleave from the Oregon Farm Bureau would have been here, but he is ill, and I told him he's better stay out of the building if he's feeling a little bad. So he has more technical knowledge than I do. But the common denominator, what you heard from Representative Krieger and Boone, and certainly Representative Roblin, is a bipartisan nature of this bill. It is visionary. And it's a realistic way to prevent liquidation of vital assets when we try to look at the estate tax. The intent and purpose is not to obfuscate tax liability, rather end the burden when death occurs. And so there are five main issues that we've asked legislative council to draft with this bill. It is largely a technical bill to try to make it so the law that you passed in 2007 and the law you passed in 2008 actually works. So rulemaking is always an adventure, and we always find out where we have where the words matter and where they fall short. So I would just say that the amendments that you'll be seeing and you can hear from our technical folks, we think get you a long ways towards making this actually work for those you intend. In conclusion, we do feel that the passage of 3201 in 2007 and 3618 in 2008 did more for preserving the family farm from generation to generation than you've done on land use bills in a decade. You'll do more to help farmers. The good news is also that we've included fisheries in this. They're ones that are often not talked about, but you can't strip off the fishing equipment to sell it and still have it be a viable enterprise. So that's the reason that we included them. So I thank you for your time today, for your continued patience on this bill, but I want to get it, I am committed to help you get it right. We've worked in the interim to do just that, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, please.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Tammy Denny. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. You also have my written testimony in front of you this morning, and I beg the committee's indulgence that we would support House Bill 3305, but also call to your attention an injury that unintentionally occurred with the passage of House Bill 3618 out of the special session. You've heard the background from very competent staff this morning and also from the bipartisan work group that assisted in trying to craft the right rules. Unfortunately, there were at least 14 farm families that were injured by the passage of House Bill 3618, one of which is Mr. Wes Grilley, one of my predecessors who served as the executive director for the Oregon Wheat Growers League for more than 17 years. He approached my office after receiving a notification from the Department of Revenue that he owed $46,000 in arrears in a retroactive tax after his mother's estate was closed, after it was probated. He received a bill in the mail for $46,000. He had to go back to the other siblings, the other members of the estate who had received that property distribution, and ask them to assist in paying that $46,000. He wasn't the only individual. As we understand it, Department of Revenue assisted Senator Nelson in a mailing to identify other potential natural resource families that had faced similar circumstances. 13 additional families responded to that mailing, so we know of 14 families who have said, I am in a similar situation. They range in injury from $12,000 to $85,000. That is significant, and that was not the intention of the passage of House Bill 3618. And again, with your indulgence, we understand that this is the third time around this issue, and we want to work as an organization. You will see by the attached document that the Oregon Wheat Growers League was prominent in its support of House Bill 3618, and we want to be part of the solution in passing 3305. We understand that House Bill 3305 wasn't crafted to deal specifically with this retroactive taxation issue, but we wanted to bring it to your attention because it was one of those unintended consequences. These are huge policy issues that you're attempting to address, and we appreciate your willingness to once again focus on these issues. We know the issues are many during the session, and we understand that these are complex. The policy, however, needs to direct the Department of Revenue in a way that is without confusion and without question as to what your intent is. And I don't believe the intent of the legislative body out of the special session was to reach backwards and affect the estates that had already been probated. So we ask for your assistance. We do support the passage of House Bill 3305 and ask for your assistance and, once again, your indulgence as we move forward attempting to craft the right solution to reverse that injury for those what we know to be 14 farm families at this point in time. Thank you very much for your service, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Let me just add to make a comment about the last couple of comments. When we worked in 2008 on the bill that year, it was done with the understanding that we had not made it particularly clear what our intent was in the 2007 bill on a number of vital topics. We got a great deal of help at that point from the estate attorneys, one of whom is about to testify today. And I think that contrary to what you just said, I think it was, in fact, our intent to reach backwards to the beginning of 07 to affect the estates that may have already been probated. I don't think that was an accident. I think it was done intentionally by the legislature as part of the clarification of the bill. Now, it doesn't mean we can't revisit the issue, but it was done intentionally. I should also tell you that Senator Farioli raised this issue with me during the interim, during 08, and I have to tell you, I can't remember exactly what month it was, but it was quite some time ago. At that time, I asked him for specifics about what the issues were and what the problems were that were caused by the 08 bill. I have yet to receive any of that information, and I think that it would be very helpful for the committee if we had the specifics of what the problems were for those families. The reason that I asked for that specifically was that I wanted to make certain that the changes that caused the estates to pay additional taxes were not the changes that we thought were necessary in order to clarify what we'd intended in the first place, that they were in fact something else. Because if they were simply changes to clarify what we intended in the first place, then the additional taxes were due. And the change in the statute simply meant that we saved a lot of costly litigation on everybody's part in order to get that done. So I would be pleased to receive more information in detail about what the problems were that came about as a result of the look back to the beginning of 07. I haven't gotten it yet, and I sort of wonder what happened. And I really do appreciate the fact that you've raised the issue again. But I'm not prepared, at least personally, to move ahead on that issue without understanding precisely what the problem was that led to it. Simply the fact that estates had to pay some additional tax because we clarified the law is not very persuasive to me personally. Now, the committee may think differently. I'm not speaking for them, only for myself. Did you want to respond to that?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, please. Members of the committee, what I do have in my file that I can provide for you if you're interested in receiving it are letters from each of the 14 family members who were the executors of their respective estates describing in detail the injury and what had occurred that the estates were planned under current law. Mm-hmm. When their loved one passed away, mm-hmm. that estate was planned under current law, and then to receive a bill after the fact is what has created the issue, of course.
Right.
And so I do have copies of those letters. I will be glad to provide them to the committee administrator if that would be of assistance to the committee.
I think it would, and I've received some letters. I will say that the letters I've received do not contain the details that we need in order to have any idea as to whether or not there's an equitable argument here. We simply don't know from the information we've received that there was additional tax levied doesn't help us understand that issue.
We will go back to work on getting you more detail, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Stone.
Jeff Stone, Oregon Associated Nurseries. Mr. Chair, we did seek a remedy on the Senate side with the House Senate Bill 347, introduced by Senator Nelson. We wish to, I'm really glad that Tammy could be here today to talk about kind of the flip side of what happens when a rule is not fully known when you implement it. So we don't want certainly have more families suffer that same issue, but we will work with the Wheat Growers League. We've committed to work with them to try to make sure that folks who are unintentionally harmed have a way to talk to you about it, and so I'll be happy to work with you and members of the committee as you see fit.
Thank you, and I appreciate that very much. It isn't our intention to harm families that relied on the rules. What we need to do is make certain what we're dealing with are real problems rather than ones that came about because of differing interpretations in the original statute. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, are we going to hear from other witnesses about the details of this bill and why those changes are needed? So far, we haven't heard that information from anyone.
Mr. Chair, we saved the best for last.
Thank you very much.
The practitioners will forget more than I know.
All right. Thank you. I see that the storm has not arrived in the room, so we'll proceed with Jeff Sheen and Doug Cushing. And again, we appreciate very much your gentlemen's you gentlemen's willingness to take your time to come and help the committee as we work on complex issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sheen's delivering his papers. My name is Douglas Cushing. I'm with the law firm of Jordan Schrader Ramis in Lake Oswego. We are counsel to the Oregon Association of Nursing. I did not submit a written material. We hope to be able to answer any questions you may have. I would just note that one of the key things that has led to this amendment, we believe, is a combination of a number of attorneys from around the state. Mr. Sheen and I both happen to come from the Portland area, but counsel from the Eastern District of the state, Eugene, Salem, have been very involved in the working group. The CPA group has provided a number of practitioners who contributed. We work with the Department of Revenue through the rulemaking process at least twice, three, four times. I'm not sure how many times we've been through that. And Ms. Toswill on the Legislative Council, who assembled the comments from all of us. A number of the things I think are relatively simple. The CPI indexing is, we think, going to be important, but it's not going to be a huge impact as was feared, I think, when we worked on 3618 in the special session. I believe we all at that point were still perhaps riding high and figured the increasing values might make a significant impact. If you look at the fact that Social Security has just indicated they don't see forecasting increases till 2012, perhaps, we don't think this is going to be a significant cost factor. It will ultimately work its way up, we hope. We're not sure how quickly. The elimination of the pickup tax for the need to sell property to pay estate or property taxes, we think, is simply a fairness issue, that if you've had to sell something to pay the tax that remained due for either the federal estate tax or the Oregon tax, you shouldn't then have to pay another tax on top of it. The credit table changes, I think, are very self-explanatory, that in effect we had a complicated system that worked its way up to the 7.5. This simplifies that. The working capital and marital deduction issues.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that last point again a little more slowly?
I think that the credit table that we all, and I say because it was a large group of us, I remember very large meeting, I think, a time or two, was a complicated process. And basically, giving the credit to 7.5 was what was originally intended, and that's what it now does. The fall-off, then, that occurs as you go to a $15 million estate is what was understood to be appropriate, because if you're that large, you know, as you get over that threshold, then it's not appropriate to have a further credit. Mr. Sheen will address more directly the working capital and the marital deduction issues, and one other technical slight change we think we need to be made. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Matt Manson.
The credit table, tell me, so what's the problem with the credit table? Why are we cutting it?
Yeah, that's the part I still didn't understand it, even with the increased explanation.
It's going back, if you will, to the original intent that there will be an exclusion, which, as it basically, the idea was that up to 7.5 it wouldn't be paid. Because of the exclusion impact and shifting the entire taxing structure, basically, you know, you started out at 8.5 before you had any tax accrual. So this seemed to match what was intended 3 years ago, but without the adverse impact on the budget, as we understood when we went through the 3618 analysis.
So when you say this, you mean this bill?
This bill, the 3305.
Thank you. Now I understand the point you're making. Yeah, please go ahead. You were on point four.
And I was saying that the issue of the marital deduction and the working capital, Mr. Sheen can address more directly than myself, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of this committee. My name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney and member of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm a partner with the law firm of Samuels, Yolen, Cantor, Seymour, and Spinrad in Portland, Oregon. When House Bill 3618 was passed last year, there were some issues that were left to consider in this session, such as the inflation adjustment and other policy inconsistencies. I'm here this morning as a member of the ad hoc work group of attorneys and accountants who worked with the House Revenue Committee last session on House Bill 3618. The work group appreciated the opportunity to work with the committee last year, and we appreciate the opportunity to meet with you this morning. I understand that you do not have purview to a dash one amendment, which has some minor corrections. So if that's the case, I won't speak to that.
We actually received something that looks like it might be the dash one amendment on the back of the second sheet of paper attached to the Oregon Association of Nurseries testimony. It's in the right form, and so it may very well be a dash one, but this is the first time I've seen it.
So if I can speak perhaps to that, generally the proposed dash one amendments from a work group's perspective we support. But the one issue that I wanted to look at that didn't get addressed and is talked about on page one of my materials is Section 5D of the bill, which appears on the last two lines on page 4, that's lines 44 and 45, and the top two lines on page 5, lines 1 and 2. The intent of what happened after the passage of 3618 is the Oregon Department of Revenue adopted a series of rules which reflected their interpretation as the laws, as the department understands it. And a question was asked of the department, well, what if you have to use some of the natural resource property that is eligible for credit to pay a state tax or inheritance tax? Because notwithstanding all this, some is due. And the department, I think, you know, consistent interpreted the law correctly, came back and said, well, that constitutes a disposition of natural resource property and will trigger a recapture tax. And that is in the rule that was adopted at OAR 150-118.145B. And this appears to be inconsistent with kind of the intent of this bill in the first place, is that, if you know, the idea was you shouldn't have to sell a bunch of trees prematurely to pay tax, but rather defer. So now we're caught with a situation where you do have to sell some trees to pay some tax, and, oh, by the way, that constitutes a recapture. The problem with the bill, that's 3305, as drafted, is that it has that exception, but it only applies, as it says, to condemnations, which is the reference in 4D of the bill. So that makes this provision apply to a very rare circumstance. In other words, you have a taxpayer who has had property condemned, who now wants to use some of that to pay inheritance tax with, that won't constitute a recapture. We think the provision should be broader than that. And I have put in my materials at the bottom of page 1 and at the top of page 2 a suggested amendment to that section, which basically recognizes, if it's the policy decision of this committee, to allow, if you have to pay taxes, inheritance tax or estate tax, that's not going to trigger the recapture tax, even though you have to use natural resource property to do that. The idea behind the... Are there any questions on that before...
Are there questions on that? I have a comment. I'm not sure it's a question. I'm not at all sure that... Well, I guess I do have a question. Could you describe the circumstances under which that... that particular section would come into effect?
Well, in the circumstance, let's just say hypothetically there's a $300,000 federal estate tax bill due, and the character of the assets of the estate are essentially the only assets available might be working capital or some other provision that property that gets sold that happens to be natural resource property. So if the taxpayer has chosen to report that property on the inheritance tax return as being natural resource property, and then they have to turn around and use that property, either sell it or use cash from working capital to pay the inheritance tax or the federal estate tax bill, they now have a compounding effect of having to pay tax on the what they liquidated to pay the tax with. So that's the circumstance where this would arise.
Mr. Chair.
That's
Mazin. Mr. Chair, I feel another work group coming.
I nominate Representative Berger.
it was Representative Collier out of order.
It would be really helpful in understanding the bill because I think it was described as some technical adjustments, technical changes. While many of the things I'm looking at are new policies or expansion of policy. If there is a way to zero on what is the technical difficulties that were faced with the technical interpretation of the bill, of the law, and separate from, so I could understand it for the new work group.
Well, I guess, reluctantly, I would say, we're making ourselves available to be part of a work group if that's the decision of this committee. But I think this particular issue is kind of it's technical in the sense because the department has said, by way of rulemaking, that if you use natural resource property to pay inheritance or estate tax, that you've claimed as natural resource property on the return, then that constitutes triggers a recapture tax. Okay, that's...
Let's be clear. A recapture tax simply means that you have to pay the tax that you would have paid had you not claimed this as natural resource property, or does it mean something else?
You essentially, Chair Barnhart, I think that captures the essence of what a recapture tax is.
Could you repeat that for me?
Yeah, what I said was, a recapture tax essentially means that you would pay the tax that you otherwise would have paid had you not claimed the property as natural resources property.
That's correct.
Okay. That's correct.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. And then I interrupted your answer, your response, so go ahead with the other point you were on.
So I think in a sense, this aspect is kind of a policy question, is do we add tax on top of a tax, because as you liquidate to pay the estate tax or the inheritance tax, and now you have a recapture tax to deal with, now you have to liquidate more, and you start to get into kind of a circular, because if you have to use natural resource property to pay the recapture tax, then you have to, you know, liquidate more natural resource property, and it becomes, it's a solvable math problem, but it becomes a circular issue. And so
you have to use calculus rather than arithmetic.
Yeah. So that's, I think, the essence of that particular correction is just as a policy, if it's the policy of, it seems to be, that not to overburden farms and forest land, that this would make sense to do. But again, it's a policy decision.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Can we go back? Because I'm trying to track here.
Please, go ahead. Yeah.
In this bill, is that addressed?
Yeah. No.
No. This is something that's in
House Bill, or Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger. House Bill 3305, as drafted in Section 5D, attempts to address what I've talked about. However, the reference in that subsection that refers to 4D refers to what essentially is a condemnation section. And so, in effect, the way it's drafted right now, it really doesn't accomplish anything except in the rare circumstance where you have a taxpayer who's had some of their property condemned.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
In the bill as drafted, 3305.
Correct.
This is attempted to be solved in a section, but it doesn't solve it in that section. So the amendment tries to get at it?
Well, my notes try to get at it that are not at the bottom of page one of my testimony to the written testimony is what tries to get there.
What I, if I may, Representative Berger, we have some a substantially larger amount of other business to get to today. I would like to let these gentlemen finish
their
testimony,
fine.
And then we may, in fact, need to follow through on the suggestion from wherever it came for our work group. And recognize today is the 5th of May, so it's going to be a chore for us to actually get something out this session. But I think a work group process may be, in fact, much more expeditious than trying to do it here.
We also have not had the opportunity yet to review this with Ms. Toswell and Legislative Council. They may concur with us. We haven't addressed that yet,
yeah.
Mr. Barker.
Well, the plain language certainly appears of the bill certainly appears to support Mr. Sheen's contention. Just because of the way it's drafted, it would certainly seem to apply only to property which is converted as a result of a condemnation. Well, it's section 1033, which I assume is condemnation.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you. Please, let's finish up this, and then I have some other members who would like to testify, and then we'll get back to the last of our list.
Well, and in deference to the committee, I don't know to what extent you want to go through. I have some comments to sort of explain the reason for the marital deduction provision, and I put a chart on here to kind of illustrate on page 2 of my written materials the reason why that section is in there. And basically the bill as drafted last year, and because of the rules that the department has adopted, where if a taxpayer in an estate takes a marital deduction election on a federal estate tax return, they're bound to use that same election on the Oregon inheritance tax return. And in the diagram, just to kind of go fairly quickly, that I have presented to you is a very typical estate planning transaction for this size of estate is to create out of the deceased spouse's share what we call a QTIP trust, which stands for Qualified Terminal Interest Trust. The purpose of the QTIP trust is it makes the income and principal generally available to the surviving spouse, and then when the surviving spouse passes away, that property passes on to the heirs, like children and things of that nature. But the way the QTIP trust operates is that when the surviving spouse passes away, the assets in the QTIP trust are part of the taxable estate of the surviving spouse. So if we put natural resource property into a QTIP trust, and that causes the, and that becomes included with the surviving spouse's natural resource property, to the extent that that pushes the amount over $7.5 million, then the surviving spouse's estate ends up with a reduction in their natural resource credit. And so what we're trying to create in this bill is to give the representatives of the estate the option to take the marital deduction for federal purposes, but claim the full natural resource credit for Oregon purposes. And the department seems that we don't doesn't think that it's got the authority to do that at the present time. And so, again, that's kind of a cleanup issue. And working capital might make more sense if the work group goes forward to address that. But I will tell you that a couple weeks ago I met with a lady out in Carlton who has a winery, and she was telling me that they've had their grapes in for 10 years, and they're starting just this year to get their cash investment back. And so the working capital definition that was presented by and adopted by the department tends to be a little bit restrictive in that it only looks at a 12-month period. And there are many natural resource products that have a life cycle much longer than 1 year. Grape vineyards are an example of that. And this definition that's in the materials was provided by CPA Cliff Benz, and it's based on GAAP standards. So, I mean, it does have a basis in accounting rules. And
I think you're referring to Clint.
Clint, I'm sorry. I apologize. So,
only a couple letters different, but actually
that's
a different
true.
Person.
Yes. And unfortunately, he is out of town, or he would be here to present today. So I think I would conclude at this point, because I know the committee has a lot of business to deal with, and I but we would be available to deal with questions or how the committee wants to proceed.
Thank you. Are there questions now for these two gentlemen? I have to say that we very much appreciate your continuing work on this ongoing controversy. I am, if the committee has your contact information, if legislative revenue office has your contact information, I would like to set up a work group, and I will be around committee members to find out who'd like to serve on that work group. I expect there's only time for one or two meetings at the most if we're going to have any chance of getting any of these fixes through. And I would say that some of the things that we've heard from about so far are things that changes in what the committee did intentionally. Others are things that perhaps we didn't consider fully, and it's the ones we didn't consider fully that I think the work group probably ought to work on. But rather than prejudge that, I'd like to thank you very much and hear from the other members, and then we have one more witness after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll make ourselves available.
Thank you. We appreciate that very much. Senator Nelson, Representative Barnard, did you want to be heard? And the storm has still not arrived, so we'll hear from these other gentlemen. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, northeast part of Oregon. And I was listening to your testimony on TV, and I introduced a bill 347 in the Senate that had a hearing. It was a specific example, and I heard the chair ask, what are the specific examples and details? And so I'll just tell that story real quick. Like, my client's name is Wes Grilley. He was one of two surviving heirs of his mother who passed away, the wheat farmers. She passed away in April of 2007. So as the estate was being probated, they came under the law as passed in 2007. The estate was settled the property was distributed to the heirs, and they were going on with their life. And then 2008 special session came along, and there was a change. And so then they got a bill, and their bill was like $45,000, something of that nature. So the problem was, is since the estate had already been closed or cleared, one of the siblings took their proceeds from the estate and basically spent it. And so they were relying upon the law as they felt at the close of their estate. And then to get this retroactive provision that applied clear back to 2007 had put them out of the exemption or the exclusion portion of it. So then they had an additional $45,000 of taxes. There was, like, I think, 13 estates that maybe had some sort of story similar to that for a total of not quite $500,000. So there is a fiscal impact in this thing. But if you were looking for a specific example, they relied upon the law as it was when the estate was closed, and then all of a sudden the rules are changed on them. And so, you know, it's one of those things that a little bit less trust in what we're doing here in government.
Thank you. Representative Clem, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. I'm Representative Brian Clem from District 21 here in Central and East Salem, also chair of the Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee that sent you this bill with the unanimous do-pass recommendation. Happy to be here to testify in support of the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. And, you know, just briefly, in 07, I had a different bill and saw that Representative Krieger and Boone were working hard on a vehicle that discussed natural resource properties in general, whether it's fishing boats or small forest operations or agriculture. And so I decided to team up with them rather than try and advance as a freshman a standalone bill that was probably not, I don't know if I would have got a hearing even, but maybe. And it was a wise decision for the members of both parties and interested in kind of three different sectors that are all encompassed in this bill to join forces, and got a very strong bill encompassed inside of a larger omnibus tax bill. That session, we came back in 08. That session was the one where we clearly knocked my family out, which was a positive thing in my view, from ever getting to use this. The 50% threshold, my father-in-law had already passed away before, he passed away in 04, so we'd already gone through estate tax planning and, you know, spent a lot of money doing our planning, and so we had gifting and other strategies where it doesn't affect people who have a lot of resources put into planning, the current estate tax law, unless they're very large, and then even with estate tax planning, it's difficult to not find yourself in a situation where you may end up feeling the need to sell property or shares, move it around within the family in order just to pay the taxes. And that's the whole concern with the estate tax law as it applies to natural resource properties. Now, I'm not a proponent of repealing the estate tax law, or in general, unless you deal with the stepped-up basis issue, changing it drastically. But when you are land-rich and cash-poor, and we're trying to promote farms and forest and fishing in this state as an ideal industry that's both renewable and green, I think there is a cause for consideration of these things. And so now we're, you know, and the legislature agreed with that in both those 07 and 08. We tightened it in 08 to make sure that it wasn't people who had lots of other assets, and so we put a threshold in before you were eligible. That, as I mentioned in our case, that would have terminated the family because they had diversified into all kinds of other things, and so the orchard was a small fraction of their holdings, and that's fine. That was the point of the bill. Now we're back talking about and I agree, it's not all technical. There's a couple policy items. The indexing of the tax what are we, exclusion or exemption? I forget. But anyway, the indexing issue. And it's something that when I'm talking with agricultural producers who are now paying a pretty hefty increase on the minimum wage this year, it's about the one thing that gives some sense of fairness as well. At least could we make an effort at getting some indexing back on the relief that we get from taxes since we're going to be paying it on the minimum wage side. And I think it would be wise to put it back in. I can certainly tell you from a working capital standpoint in our orchard, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars that just stay in the reserve fund, and they just stay there all the time. They almost never come out, much to my chagrin when I want to pay taxes, but they just stay there because they're for the long-term horticultural aspects of you know, a 50-year growing cycle potentially on a given tree. And so those dollars... you know, if a parent passed away and we had to get into the working capital, that's how we grow the crop the next year, and so we don't go into debt, is we leave it there for the future of the business and not for our own needs, family needs. So it is important that working capital is protected. I think with that, if there's a work group, I'd certainly be interested in being on it myself. It may be a chore, but it's also a chore for me to vote for a bunch of other taxes that on some of these same people without trying to take care of this session, and I'm happy to do both. So especially, I get the corporate minimum question from my farmers when I go to visit with them, and I say, well, at least we're working on something over here on the relief side, and that seems to help slightly the pitchfork rebellion that usually begins when I say something like that. With that, it's an important priority for the Ag Committee. That's why I'm here, and several other members of the committee were here. We believe it is it's a land use policy as well to try and preserve these in the farming arena and forest land arena. We want to preserve these things for working farms and forests, and so along with our land use laws, you need to have an economic climate where they can continue to survive regardless of the zoning. And I consider it something that is a hallmark opportunity to finally finish up on, and I don't want to wait till next session because this is the third one we've had to deal with it, and I'm sure you don't want to have to deal with it again either if we can just get it working right and implement it the way that folks envision it. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to appear in front of you and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for our esteemed members?
One of them's esteemed, the senator.
I have one. I think you were describing what the bill is trying to get at when it describes material property recovery account, when you talk about reserves. Is that a fair comparison?
I wish I was an accountant now. I know that when we're talking about working capital in my world, mm-hmm. it is a reserve or retains that stay at our co-op, and they are there. I don't know if that's the legalese to translate it into, what the bill calls it, but it's monies that sit there that we use to grow the next year's crop, and it fluctuates pretty wildly throughout the year. I mean, it could be at a low point, $110,000, a high point, $490,000. It ranges back and forth between there, depending on where sales are at and how many expenses we've made. The worst time is in about September, so don't ask me for a loan right then because it's, we've paid everything, we've got nothing back yet.
A business that you're associated with tends to have an annual cycle.
Yeah, it's a fruit orchard tree. Right. So we cherries, apples, and pears pick them each year.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Jody Weiser. Now, is there anyone else who has a hugely burning desire to be heard today on this bill? Yes. The department, please. Thank you. I should have asked you earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee. Why don't you go ahead while Jody's coming?
Thank you, sir. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to one of the questions that came up on the retroactive impact from the 2008 legislation. We did examine returns, and while I cannot disclose particulars of any individual return, in looking at those returns that qualified under the 2007 law and then were retroactively disallowed, the majority of them failed to meet the 50% threshold for qualified assets. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Jody.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness, Oregon. In our group, our name for this bill is the Estate Tax Exemption Expansion Bill. For while it appears to restrict the meaning of working capital, its language actually seems to expand the size of what farmers, foresters, and fishermen won't pay taxes on. For example, in the legislature's earlier effort to allow natural resource holders to have benefits other citizens don't, they explicitly decided that the trustee and heirs needed to decide if they wanted to use these provisions or provisions of the federal law. But on page 5, section 3, that decision is reversed with the words, elections under federal law are not binding on Oregon inheritance tax liability. Similarly, the original provision was designed for heirs that wanted to continue operating the farm if half or more of the estate is natural resource property. Under the design, a family would have about $7.5 million in timber business and $7.5 million in cash, home, stocks, or whatever, and pay little or no taxes at all on the timber operations. Wasn't exactly at $7.5 million, because one of the adjustments that was made with about 15 people in the room one night was a decision to, instead of having a cliff at $7.5 million, to have it go back down to $15 million. And in that agreement that was made then, it was decided that the people at $7.5 million wouldn't get the full amount of, it's all tax-free, in order to pay for the easing down towards the $15 million estate rather than having the cliff. Now people are coming in and saying, oh, we didn't get what we asked for. We wanted 7.5. Well, you agreed to have the cliff disappear, and you have to stay with that agreement, or you're expanding the law beyond what the original intent was. This provision authorizes exemption from taxes for this very timber property, in this example, even if some of it is sold. There does seem to be a limit. It's the amount needed to pay the taxes on what was sold. This is a nice trick if you can get the legislators to do it. But the original idea was not to allow a family, was to allow a family to preserve the forest, not sell it, and avoid paying the inheritance tax. On page 3, beginning on line 29, the bill asks to grow the size of the exemption for inflation, city inflation. We simply can't afford this new program or any other programs with expansions like this, and this would be a program expansion. Well, indexing makes good sense. There's irony in the fact that the advocates for this bill are the same ones who we've heard year after year fight to remove minimum wage indexing for their own workers. These are the easy provisions of House Bill 3305, but the big project of this bill seems to be to expand what a family can claim to be part of a farm, forest, or fishing operation. While on page 2, line 15, we see a limit on how much working capital is to be claimed, no more than 20% of all business assets. Is that business assets or all assets? The language isn't clear. What does line 17 actually mean? I think I agree with Mazin that it's 20% of the whole thing, which would mean that an estate with natural resource property could get a $9 million estate through without taxes rather than a $7.5 million estate through without taxes. That's not what we're setting up to do in 2007 or in 2008. One can work hard to understand this provision, and certainly the courts will if we ever get a new Oregon estate tax auditor to audit and question an estate's use of the $7.5 versus $9 million provision of this bill. But while you're busy trying to figure out what the provision about working capital means, it's easy to lose track of the inclusion of a new animal, the material property recovery account. What is that? There's no definition for this in federal law, so this is going to be another piece that we'll have to come back year after year to try to figure out the meaning of, and it'll probably be worked to extended. According to the definitions on page 1, this account seems to be cash, bonds, or stock intended to recover or replace crops, machinery, or barns. The savvy farmers will say all their assets not employed in farming, that other 50% of their estate, is intended for recovery and replacement of material property, and it will be placed or titled into its material property recovery account. What does recovery actually mean in this context? With this section, does everything except the beach house or the Pearl District condo become part of the farm? I don't think it's clear. The limits of working capital become a matter of indifference when one can accumulate assets you don't actually use ever in your growing cycle, which in some cases can be as long as 80 years, because we had a bill before us talking about alder trees that have a long farming cycle of 30 years, and of course, forests are grown for 80 years sometimes. Now, you can name them as part of your material property recovery account. And finally, on page 2, what is line 25 accomplishing? We see nothing in this bill that needs to be done and much that needs to be clarified or avoided. Our guess is that every year, a portion of the natural resource community will bring forward legislation to expand this law. Our response, did we sit where you are, would be to amend it with a gut and stuff that removes entirely the provisions offering working capital to owners of natural resource property. That ends that discussion. Or better yet, remove the entire natural resource exemptions and treat this group of wealthy Oregonians, that treat this group of wealthy Oregonians better than all others. For many, many years on our family farm, we had no working capital except what we got from the bank. It really isn't horrible to think of a farm where half of the assets are not in the farm and they're left without working capital, and that next generation is somewhat in the position that their parents were in, or their grandparents were in, or their great-grandparents were in when this farming operation began. Earlier, you heard testimony that spoke to the difficulty of often was repeated, having to cut trees that you weren't intending to cut. That forgets entirely the provision in law that says you have 14 years to pay your taxes if you have natural resource property. That really is quite a long extension on the growing cycle of any crops grown in this state, and probably adequately meets the need and mitigates the cogency of saying we'll have to cut trees we didn't intend to cut. I think I spoke to all my points. Thank you.
Are there questions for Ms. Weiser? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it. Colleagues, that concludes the witnesses that we have for this bill today, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3305 and open a public hearing on House Bills 2180 and House Bill 3253. 26 tomorrow. Okay. And while we're getting ready, let me announce that we're not going to be hearing House Bill 2626 today. The amendments that we need are not ready. We're carrying House Bill 2626 over until tomorrow in hopes that the amendments will be ready then. So we will not be hearing that one today. If anyone's here for that bill, we apologize, but we simply don't have the final amendments that we need. Chris, let's tell us about 2180 and 3253.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very briefly, being cognizant of the time of your earlier start time for the floor session, which I believe starts at 9:45, just very briefly, House Bill 3253A creates an income tax credit for plug-in electric vehicles that is up to $5,000 and limits the number of vehicles per year for taxpayer to five. And that would be a new tax credit, and people would not be eligible for that credit if they claim the RETC credit. House Bill 2180 makes some changes to three different credits, the Betsy credit, the RETC credit, and the biomass credit. Again, briefly, the Betsy credit, it adds industrial process energy facilities, makes them eligible for the 50% credit, and it also makes some definitional changes to the recycling facility projects that are eligible for the BETC. RETC, it adds hydroelectric generating systems to the credit if they're up to 10 megawatts in capacity. It also adds plug-in vehicle credit to the RETC and allows the Department of Energy to consider factors such as petroleum use and efficiency and market acceptance in determining the amount of the credit. And it lowers the credit for other hybrids to $750 from $1,500. The bill also refines the definitions pertaining to the biomass producer-collector credit, such as refining it for the definition of biofuel, what counts as biofuel, as well as who is a biofuel producer. And it grants DOE, Department of Energy, rulemaking authority for defining the characteristics of biomass eligible for the credit and establishing a discount rate for the transfer of the credit. And it also establishes a certification process within the Department of Energy, and they share that information with the Department of Revenue. So those are some of the highlights.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nathanson, for sitting through that earlier testimony. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representing House District 13. Compared to the description of the second bill you're considering, mine is going to seem extremely simple. This bill, 3253, is about jobs. It's also about the environment and health. It's looking to the future. It's a fairly narrow, targeted tax credit for electric vehicles. I have prepared an amendment which adds a sunset date. You should have that. And I have also prepared an amendment to House Bill 2472, which removes or backs out a current tax credit for hybrid vehicles. And I'll explain that in a moment. The technology for hybrid electric vehicles is well developed. The market is well established. This bill, 3253, is a way to encourage a new and rapidly growing industry in the production of electric drive vehicles. And that production, unlike the hybrid vehicles that we're purchasing today, the production for electric vehicles could be here in Oregon. This bill is written to ensure that tax credits will apply to a wider array of vehicles than what we happen to encourage today. I'd like us to be able to encourage vehicles for low- and middle-income families. Four-wheel, four-door sedans are great family cars. Three-wheel cars for trips to work ought to be available, too. Fuel-efficient driving at highway speeds is great. But what about how great it would be to have even greater fuel efficiency for all those single-occupant vehicle trips that so many people are making to work? I want to tell you a little bit about why I think we need to encourage electric vehicles and how this bill will help Oregon. I also want to add a special point for you to consider as you listen to the testimony, mine and the other testimony you'll hear today. Automaking is not just about the giants in the industry. First of all, the economic benefits. We have companies in Oregon today, right now, working on designing and building electric vehicles and the parts that go into them. Tax credits would be awarded will contribute to economic activity in this state and preserving or creating new jobs in Oregon. The recent troubles of the RV manufacturing industries have left thousands of skilled workers unemployed who could immediately be employed in the electric vehicle industry, and I've even heard about a few already. The current recession provides a unique opportunity to realign Oregon's struggling manufacturing base toward a new long-term growth industry that would provide high-quality, living-wage jobs for years to come. Those jobs would be in many sectors, including manufacturing, engineering, design, fabricating components, electric charging infrastructure, renewable energy installation, and the associated administrative, professional, and marketing work. There are some other benefits to encouraging electric vehicles. First of all, keeping money in Oregon. We would be redirecting fuel expenses to local utilities. The average Oregon driver would spend $250 a year at local utilities rather than sending $1,100 a year or more to out-of-state petroleum companies. Approximately 85,000 cars are sold in Oregon each year, about $2 billion in sales. All of those are built out of state. Redirecting some of that production to in-state, to local manufacturers, would stimulate our economy. There's great savings for car owners also. Electric vehicles are cheaper to run. From what I can tell from research, unlike supporting a combustion engine car, the average Oregon driver, so this benefits low- and middle-income families even greater, would save about $2,000 a year in fuel and maintenance costs by switching to an electric vehicle. And savings for taxpayers, Electric vehicles are lighter than gasoline-powered vehicles. This will reduce the amount of wear and tear on our crumbling infrastructure, slowing down the rate of road deterioration, so all the taxpayers benefit from that. The environmental benefits are clear. An electric vehicle charged on the Pacific Northwest electricity grid will produce about 5 times less carbon dioxide than a 30-mile-per-gallon combustion vehicle. Reduced pollution in cities is important as we eliminate emissions of volatile organic compound and carbon monoxide. Coupled with 90% reduction in nitrogen oxides, we'll have cleaner city air and healthier people. The public health officer for Lane County, Dr. Sarah Hendrickson, tells us, quote, diesel and gasoline emissions are both linked to an increase in respiratory health problems. We know that gasoline gives off a benzene vapor, a carcinogen that is cancer-causing. It makes sense to move to electricity. And finally, batteries are recyclable. 97% of lead-acid batteries are fully recycled. Other battery chemistry recycling technology is coming online, including a company in Bend, Oregon, that's leading in the field. So in closing, I would just like to say that Oregonians have already shown an interest in hybrid electric vehicles. Let's help provide the next option, which is electric drive vehicles. This would help position Oregon as a leader in the emerging electric vehicle market. In discussing this with people who understand the needs of business, it seems that what is best for business in a capital-intensive venture is to as important as it is to the business to have help with creating the infrastructure, with the finding the location and developing the site, it's just as important to the business to understand that a market is going to be there, that they have someone to sell the product to. So is this idea realistic? Should we be promoting electric cars for Oregon? I think we should. 72.5% of the workers in Oregon are commuting alone in cars. We should not be limited to only conventional cars designed with gas engines to travel 65 miles an hour and handle 370 miles on a tank of gas. It's smart to support Oregon manufacturing, and it's smart to encourage leadership with green technology. It's smart to encourage electric drive vehicles. So I hope you will be willing to do that, and I can also provide you the amendments if you don't have them. For example, I mentioned that there is a bill that adds a sunset date that I think is consistent with the sunset that this committee is considering for other credits, and also the amendment to remove hybrid, because I think it makes sense that the way to pay for encouraging these jobs in Oregon is to back out the incentive that we're providing for the hybrid market, which is already now well established. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Nathanson? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony this morning and the long wait that you had to endure while we dealt with the other bill.
Thank you.
I have one person who indicates he is from more than 100 miles away, and I'll ask him to come forward, Michael Bull. Then let's also hear from Trevor Steele and Eric Staffel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Bull from the Rogue Valley area, and here representing Wood Byproducts Consulting. Here to speak on House Bill 2180. To give you a quick background, I'm the co-owner of Wood Byproducts Consulting, and we deal with the biomass industry, both the producers, the collectors, as well as the biofuel facilities here, really all over the state. We're huge proponents of the use of biomass for green energy, not necessarily only for the primary effect, which is the clean renewable energy, but also for the secondary effects, which are the revitalization of the rural communities, the reduction of the catastrophic wildfire effects in Oregon's forests, as well as the improvement to the wildlife habitat around the state. In reading through House Bill 2180, there was just a couple of items that I noticed had some concern with. First would have been with the definition of urban waste not being included for the biomass credit. While we agree that the urban waste shouldn't be included, we would just like a more clear definition of what urban waste is or is not. in many cases we've found that it's somewhat ambiguous as to if leaves would be considered in the urban waste, if grass clippings, wood debris from residential areas that might or might not be in a mandatory recycling area all come into play when you're dealing with the urban waste type issues. Secondly, who is allowed to claim the credit? Currently, it speaks to only taxpayers or taxpaying entities being able to accumulate and then either claim or transfer off these biomass credits. And we see a little lapse in that, primarily that certain LLPs and LLCs are not considered primary taxpayers and then would not be allowed to earn and either claim or transfer these credits. Also, nonprofit organizations that are out there strictly for the betterment of the environment and Oregon's forests, that would, as they're bidding on these type projects, if they're not allowed to earn this type of tax credit, it'll be very difficult for them to be competitive with private business that is a tax-paying type entity. So we see them as being able to earn these credits and then not claim them for themselves, but be able to transfer them off as imperative to them being able to continue business within this industry. And lastly, government entities that are going out of their way to, for the betterment of the environment and Oregon's resources, to use biofuel and the biomass in Oregon, we would like to see them be able to claim the tax credit, similar to how some of those are able to claim the Betsy type credit. Thirdly, in Section 5, Subsection 2, it talks about the certification process that the DOE will be taking part in. I guess we would just like to see a maximum timeline set for that certification process. One, because it also speaks to a cutoff date as the tax due date being to when the credit needs to either be claimed on the tax return or transferred to a third party. And if that's an overly long certification timeline, we see the biofuel producer and collector is not being able to meet that time period. Lastly, the uniform pricing that is proposed to be set by the DOE, we see that as being rather troubling. As similar with the Betsy, or not similar with the Betsy, excuse me, we'd like to see the market set the uniform rate. This will enable really supply and demand to dictate what pricing is set at, and if these are sold throughout the year, the price can increase and decrease according to the market, which will make it much more efficient to find pass-through partners for these credits, which, if you're not aware, the majority of the credits are passed through to a third party, not claimed by the original producer collector. In summary, we'd like to see Oregon's renewable resources, specifically the biomass, continue to be used, and we're very supportive of that. However, we'd like to see definitive timelines set on the certification process to not be overly burdensome to the biofuel producer and collectors, as well as uniform pricing not being set but being left up to the supply and demand of the market. And lastly, to not dictate that strictly taxpayers are able to claim and enter in these credits, but that would be left open to LLCs, LLPs, and nonprofits, as well as governmental organizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Steele.
Mr. Chair, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, in light of the hour, I will go ahead and defer to Eric Stoffel, who is also from Marcomoto.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Eric Stoffel, and I'm the CEO of Arcimoto, an electric vehicle manufacturer based in Eugene, Oregon. You have my written testimony this morning in front of you, and in light of the time situation, I will summarize and go over just a couple key points so we can get straight to the questions. The first thing I would like to cover is that this is very important for the state's economic jobs and growth trajectory that needs to happen in the next few years. I think we're all on the same page that there are many people who need new work, for example, in the RV industry, that could get to work immediately in the electric vehicle space. I'm very, very excited that, for example, Arcimoto is currently employing former RV workers who are very happy and a good fit with their skill set into the tasks that we need them to do. And we look forward to hiring more people from this area. One of the things about electric vehicles that Representative Nathanson so aptly touched on is that they're a much simpler technology, and which means that if they can be built here in state, due to the fact that you do not need to burn gas with these vehicles, a lot more money can stay in state, which means people have more money to spend at local businesses and thus stimulate the local economy. I'm here to support House Bill 3253, which is a very simple, very direct, and very short time window tax credit that encourages electric vehicle production here in the state. We are very supportive of a sunset provision because we see this as a tax credit that is meant to overcome the initial market adoption risk or hump. What we mean by that is, for example, when the hybrid electric vehicle tax credit was established, hybrid electric vehicles were not being sold very frequently, and there was a doubt whether those would take off. But now, if you want to see what the effectiveness of that measure was, all you need to do is stand on the street corner in Portland for a few minutes and see how many Toyota Priuses drive by, which is the number one selling hybrid electric vehicle. We see something similar like this happening here in Oregon, which would be electric vehicles produced in Oregon, which would be have many benefits therein. One of the other things I would like to point out here is that the federal government has already recognized the benefits of these electric vehicles and established a tax credit similar to what's in House Bill 3253. House Bill 3253 has two changes to that, one of which is it's a stipulation that these vehicles need to be built in Oregon, which encourages jobs here locally as opposed to overseas or in other states. The other aspect is that it applies to a wider range of vehicles. As Representative Nathanson hinted to, this would include three-wheeled vehicles, better, lower-cost vehicles for commuting, and a wider range of vehicles that local producers are actually working on right now. The final thing I would like to say is that there are many companies that are focusing on vehicles that are low-cost and are affordable by low- to middle-income families. You may be familiar with a lot of the press regarding electric vehicles being very expensive. For example, the Tesla Roadster is $109,000, and there's a few other very high-priced products out there. But there are companies coming to market very soon that are looking at the $15,000 to $25,000 space, which a small tax credit like this could have a huge effect on the market adoption and long-term viability of this business here in Oregon. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I would be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Broom.
Oh, it's just a concern, and I'm sure you have a response to this. I'd love to hear it. I think with the current hybrids, the Prius, for example, even with the tax credit, we're still not paying them to drive on Oregon roads. They still have a little bit of skin in the game in that even if it's a greatly reduced tax, or excuse me, gas purchase, they're still buying gas and there's still a gas tax that goes with it. With the full electric, obviously paying no gas tax with up to a $5,000 credit, aren't we in effect paying these people to drive on Oregon roads? And how do we take that into for the 95% of Oregonians who won't be driving these kind of vehicles, at least for the short term, how do we sell that to them?
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Broun, I know that is an issue that's being discussed with the vehicles miles traveled and other bills that are coming forward regarding that. However, I think that the percentage of purely electric vehicles that are going to be coming out in the near future is going to be incredibly small regarding the total number of vehicles on the road. For example, 85,000 vehicles are being sold in Oregon each year. There are about 12 or 15 times that on the road currently. Electric vehicles would not be a sizable percentage for a few years at least. So the way I see it is that the benefits of electric vehicles in terms of reduced gas consumption, which means greater economic stimulus here in state, as well as the environmental benefits and the health benefits, currently outweigh, at least for the short term, the fact that they would not directly be contributing to the roads.
That's a very interesting point, Representative. Other Representative Call.
Yeah, and sorry, committee, that I'm asking a question this late hour. I'm wondering, just one very quick question. A lot of these vehicles that are being produced or envisioned aren't going to be highway vehicles. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call. For the short term, yes, that is the plan on a lot of roadmaps. However, many companies have highway-capable vehicles on the roadmaps in the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Would you describe briefly your plans, to the extent you can tell us today, for your company? And I'm particularly interested in whether you are able to produce, whether you expect to be able to produce parts locally. I know you're planning to do some assembly locally.
Absolutely. Chair Barnhart, to answer that question, I can't refer to the exact numbers that we're planning to release. However, on the order of approximately 200 to 300 vehicles in 2010 is our sales target, and on the order of approximately 900 to 1,200 vehicles in 2011 with a growth trajectory after that. Regarding how many parts and components that we can be manufacturing here, due to the density of manufacturing in Oregon due to the RV industry and some of the other industries that have left added capacity available, we are manufacturing our frames here. That is both cutting and welding. We are powder coating our frames here. We are custom engineering and manufacturing many kind of machine shop pieces that can be coming out of that, for example, A-arms for the vehicles. So all in all, we're looking at essentially almost everything except for the batteries currently, and the motor could be produced here in Oregon. However, with additional invested capital, we believe that will change. So we hope that in the near future, that being 2 to 5 years, at least the vast majority of the vehicle products, including the vehicle, would be produced here in Oregon.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Marcia Kelly, John Charles, Jody Weiser. And I'm going to, because we're running short of time and have a number of people left to go, if you could limit yourself to 2 or 3 minutes, that would be very helpful. Hit the main points.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm here as a member of the American Association University Women Public Policy Committee. And our we speak for our 2,000 members who are throughout the state. At a time when the state investment in its citizens, both young and old, is at risk, we have great concern in subsidizing purchases of the vehicles discussed in these two bills. The public subsidization of vehicles such as hybrids by the state reduces the amount that the state can pay or utilize for other services that are needed by our citizens. Media Market Research and Intelligence, part of a multinational survey, conducted thousands of surveys on the purchasers of hybrid vehicles. A few of the things that came out in that survey: nearly 80% have college degrees or postgraduate degrees. 79% have household incomes over $100,000. So if you take the $5,000 credit that you would be giving to Oregonians for purchasing a hybrid vehicle, you could pay a monthly stipend to 10 families who are on the temporary assistance for needy families. They get less than $500. The amount hasn't changed much since the 1990s. These are some of our most vulnerable citizens, and they are at risk in this current budget cycle for having many of their services canceled. We think that subsidization of maybe the industry to get it off the ground is fine, but I too share Representative Bruin's concern about the effect that these vehicles would have on paying for the services of the roads that they are using, not only for the state roads, but also for the city and county streets and roads.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon here again. I'm going to only speak to 2180A. The bill resolves a number of issues we had with the original draft of the bill. I was really pleased to see the A version. So we're happy to support much of what this bill does in terms of clarifying some of the issues. However, we differ with some of the expansions in the bill. We simply cannot afford to support tax credits for any new cars, as Representative Gelser spoke of the other day. In Section 1, we're increasing the benefit for industrial process energy-saving measures. Do we really know what these are? I think it probably means that when Genentech replaces their robotic equipment because it's worn out, and they'll get new equipment that happens to be more energy efficient, we, the taxpayers, will pick up half the bill. I don't think there's much point in that. I recently replaced my refrigerator because it stopped working after 30 years. I got tax credit for that, too. It wasn't something that, it didn't incent my behavior. It won't incent Genentech's behavior. When a machine needs to be replaced, whether it's a refrigerator or a robot, it's going to be replaced. And generally speaking, most of the equipment out there today is more efficient than the stuff that's older. So I think we're really just increasing the benefit for businesses that would have the same behavior anyway with Section 1. In Section 6, we're retaining $750 per Prius or other hybrid car. That the concept, as we've just heard about the electric cars, is that we're incenting early adopters. Well, isn't early adoption, the early adoption period for Priuses over now? And shouldn't we be reducing that benefit to zero rather than to $750? For the plug-in vehicles, well, I anticipate that the next car I buy will be a plug-in vehicle. We can't afford this as our priority today. With 12% unemployment, school days and services, for sure, facing cuts, we just can't help people buy new cars. Senator Burdick was talking to the manufacturer that is planning to move into the Freightliner facility if all goes well. She asked, if we're giving you a tax credit for manufacturing, do you also need a tax credit for buyers? And the answer was no. In fact, what they're trying to do is test market these cars in our state. If we provide a tax credit in addition to the federal tax credit, we're really either making it so every other state's going to have to do that, or we're changing the format of what they're trying to test. Will people buy this with the tax credits that are in place from the federal level? We really shouldn't push other states to get tax credits for electric cars once they've tested the model in our state, where I'm sure they will be purchased. In Section 7, we see another new cost that we can't afford. You've worked to reduce the cost of the Betsy by $8.9 million. How much of that are you willing to take from school children and give back to businesses with this bill? I hope it's none.
Thank you. And Mr. Charles, I am hoping that you're able to come back tomorrow.
Anytime.
Thank you. I did not realize, and I was just pointed out to me by Representative Vance, who has gone to the floor to read one of the courtesies early on, that we're meeting a half an hour earlier today than normal. And somehow the chair did not get the word. And I have to apologize to the others on the list who did not get to testify. I hope you can return tomorrow. We're going to set both of these bills over to be heard again tomorrow, and I hope to pick up the rest of the testimony then. I'm sorry?
H.J.
And also, we are going to set over till tomorrow H.J.M. 11. So we're setting over these two bills and H.J.M. 11. With that, we close the public hearing. Committee, we're adjourned. My apologies for keeping you long.
I don't think that's